So, folks, this is Bruce Rawls, and he is here to talk to us about connecting with our inner kindness teacher. And so, Bruce, I'm going to let go of the mic, or I'm going to mute my mic and turn it over to you, Bruce Rawls. The mic is all yours.
All righty. Well, hello, everyone. And I just thought it would be fun to talk about the not know aspect of A Course in Miracles. That's a phrase that Ken Wapnick uses frequently, and I find really helpful. And just to back up, well, Lynn and I are usually on Saturday mornings, right, Lynn? And we have a weekly conversation that usually lasts an hour, sometimes flows a little longer from 6 a.m. Pacific time, and that'd be what 9 a.m. Eastern time, and all the appropriate other times. So if you're around Saturday mornings, you can catch us then. And I also post the archives on acimblog.com as well. So along with a lot of other stuff that might be of interest and fun. So I thought it might be fun for us to talk about the not know principle, because that has I think a lot of ramifications in how we can navigate through the course and transcend the denial that the ego represents. So it's really the denial of the denial. And the denial that ego has for us is, of course, the idea that we somehow messed up perfect oneness. We think that somehow we were able to put the kibosh on perfection and our innocence and everyone else's innocence, and we think we're fugitives from peace, which is, of course, totally nuts, isn't it? So in that respect, there's plenty of places in the course. And I've also been having fun going through the frequently asked questions, and Lynn and I have been doing that for a number of weeks now, kind of in about the 1100s right now. But I just did a quick search on not know and found one that ties in really nicely. So if anybody's listening that wants to follow along, you can go to facimoutreach.org, and the frequently asked questions there are just wonderful. I started skipping around on those for years and several years, and then finally realized every single one is a gem. So I just have been going through them sequentially. I know some people have already been through all of them, all 1,300 plus of them. I'm getting close at 1,100 something, but they're really great. I mean, they're just such wonderful gems. So here's number 287, which, if you want the exact URL, it's facimoutreach.org/QA/questions/questions54.htm, and then you click on the one for question 287, and the question, and this one's particularly short. It says, one section in the text of A Course in Miracles is of particular interest to me is the quote last unanswered question, and that's from chapter 21, section 7 in the text. And it says, could you comment on the meaning of this section? And just before I read the answer, I'm just to back up a little bit. I find it always helpful to remember that the course is completely and only about the mind, and anything else is level of confusion. Which, of course, you know, as heavily invested, you know, egos, we don't like to admit. You know, we think that, you know, there's something, you know, cool and special about the self we made, and of course, that's the cause of all of our misery, but you know, we don't realize that until we take a serious look at it over time and see that it hasn't gotten us anywhere. And the scientific objectivity of, you know, Jesus or of the Course or Holy Spirit, or I like to use the term inner kindness teacher, if that awareness is ever present, I think what it continuously asks us is, so, how's that individuality thing working out for you? how's that, you know, going off on your own prodigal dreamer thing, you know, working? And if we're honest, and this is something that in one of Ken Wapnick's audios on on workbook lesson 182. He says it's not, the intent is not to make us suffer, but the intent is to have us realize how the ego's lot in its identity, its whole experience really is miserable, but it tries to disguise that. I mean, how could we be truly happy with anything less than the perfection that we are? And when we're so far down the rabbit hole, we don't even see that. I think that's another thing that I find helpful to remember, is that what awaits us as we undo and reveal the reality of our shared identity, we just get the tiniest little glimpses of, but they're real glimpses. That's the substantial, you know, like one of the sections where it says, you know, I've saved every loving thought and every kindness for you, and I paraphrase a lot, but you know where it is. Somewhere early in the text. You probably remember that section if you've read it. Anyway, so I'll go ahead and read the answer to this one about the last unanswered question and the meaning of that section. So it says, the main theme of this section is the power of our minds to choose, ultimately, against the ego. Paragraph 7 makes it abundantly clear that this is, of course, about changing our minds, not the world. It is, of course, in cause, the choices we make in our minds, not effect or behavior. And that is hugely important, isn't it? Because that basically gives us a way to actually change our experience. Because Not the world is fed back to us because we think it's actually the cause, and we've got that backwards. But if ideas never leave their source in the mind, then we really have that choice to choose. Really, it's a binary system. We only have the power to choose against the illusion instead of choosing among illusions, which is what the ego loves to have us do. Is think that illusion A is going to be better than illusion B, which was, of course, better than illusion C, and then ultimately we, you know, it wants us to try them all, you know. In the real alternative section in the text in the last chapter 31, it says, you know, perhaps you'd like to, you know, go down every road, you know, check them all out, you know. Basically, I think, you know, our inner kindness teacher is saying, you know, knock yourself out. If you really want to do that, you can. But, you know, maybe you can start to generalize and realize that what if there was a way to listen to that inner voice, that inner kindness teacher, and navigate with that and find the quality of awareness that is ever-present, that has the peace, that has that peace that we're looking for. But we don't make that. We just uncover it. I think that's where the not-know comes in. So I'm going to start over because I tend to ramble a bit. Hopefully it's helpful. It helps me. That's why I do this. So if whoever else is listening, if you find this helpful, let me know. Are you planning to make this a dialogue, Lynn? I don't know if that was clear when we set this series up, if that was going to be another set of conversations or if this was intended to be a monologue. And I'm not looking at the chat window, so if you want to...
So it's more of a monologue, yeah.
Oh,
so,
okay.
Unless you want a dialogue, but I'm interested in hearing your thoughts.
Okay, well, chime in whenever, because I certainly enjoy our conversation. So if there's anything that comes to mind, by all means, chime in. Okay.
Or if anybody has any questions, I can let you know also.
Yeah, perfect. That'd be perfect.
Very good. All right, I'm muting my mic again.
Okay. So one more time. I'll start over. And this is the answer that's provided about the last unanswered question. And it goes, the main theme of this section is the power of our minds to choose, ultimately against the ego. Paragraph 7 makes it abundantly clear that this is, of course, about changing our minds, not the world. It is, of course, in cause, the choices we make in our minds, not effect. So that's part of the not know, that it's not the effect. It's not the behavior. It's not the dream experience that the Course is asking us to change. And the world that is changed is we're changing paradigms and identities completely. So then it goes on to say, in the answer in this FAQ, says, Jesus explains that when we experience ourselves as powerless or helpless, we are giving witness to our denial of our true identity as a son of God who could never be powerless. Once this dissociation has been effected, the authentic power of our minds then is feared as the enemy, and an army of the powerless arises to do battle with this mortal threat. Okay. We think we need to ward off the reality, huh? Jesus, of course, is describing the battleground in our minds of which we are not aware because of the ego dynamic of denial and projection. Hatred seethes, that's a tongue twister word, huh? Seethes, S-E-E-T-H-E-S. Rhymes with teeths, I guess, right? Probably not too many other words that end that way. Okay, hatred, let's start that over. Hatred seethes within us. Or as, you know, Ken would say, you know, not too many course students would put over their front door a little, you know, embroidered sign that says, "Welcome to the home of evil, darkness, and sin." But that's the ego's repertoire. That's the extent of its range. You know, it doesn't know kindness. It doesn't. It's only based on fear. But it's not worthy of our contempt. It's worthy of just gently letting go of and seeing that it's silly. It's, you know, like I love so many of Ken's phrases I find really helpful. It's not evil, wicked, or sinful. It's just silly, and that's really the gist of it. I think that's what we look at when we do metaphorically pick up Holy Spirit's hand and look at our projections and look at the quality of what comes back to us and realize, no, this isn't the piece, you know, it's not the droids I'm looking for. This isn't the piece I was trying to find here. And you know, when we're honest with ourselves and realize that this world is not going to cut it for us, as the experience that we're looking for, then that frees us up to choose again. That frees us up to choose against that choice, and that's the not-no. So, okay, let me start that again. Hatred seethes within us, but is always attributed to some form of evil without, which we then feel justified in attacking and destroying. Yeah, and it's only in a dualistic system, which of course is pretty much everything that we experience by default, unless we ask for, you know, metaphorically ask for help in seeing things differently. We, by default, you know, we arrive in this world as an infant. We think that, that, you know, we're this helpless creature that needs to be bolstered and supported and nurtured and so forth. And on a level of form, yeah, it's a fearful, you know, terrorizing world. I mean, you know, with danger at every turn kind of thing. You know, and we, of course, we have, it's clever enough to make sure that we have moments of relative peace and safety. But it's all relevant. It's always the sword of Damocles, you know, hanging over our head, the other Monty Python boot about to drop from the sky at any moment, but we don't know when. You know, it's the next natural disaster or the next, bank collapse or the next, relationship, slight that turns into a big issue or a job situation that, we find untenable or whatever. You know, it's an endless string of things. But it's always a series of things that seem to come at us, and we forget that it's coming from our mind. And that is where the freedom lies. So it continues, the answer here. Jesus is also referring to the ultimate futility and silliness of the seemingly powerful armies in the world. And I mentioned this in the conversation I had with Lynn yesterday, and also another one I did earlier today with on a different program, about speaking of armies and polarization. There was a really interesting movie, if anybody hasn't seen it, called The Man Who Saved the World. And it's about a Russian military, a high-ranking military official, who was in charge of a base in 1983 that essentially saved the planet from total nuclear annihilation, because the Russian computer system that evening, late evening, early morning, I forget exactly what the timing was, but around middle of the night kind of hours, they picked up not one, two, or three, or four, but five different missile indications on their computers that indicated that Russia was being attacked by the U.S. and they were showing up on their computer tracking system. Well, yeah, okay. So what would be the appropriate protocol? Well, the retaliatory strike, right? And apparently, after that protocol, was suggested that they launch a counterattack. There was also a visual confirmation, but apparently that wasn't part of the protocol, if I understood the plot correctly. But this was not just a fictional thing. This was actually a real event that happened, and we owe this Russian officer, Stanislav Petrov, I believe is his name, an incredible debt of gratitude, because we wouldn't be here. I wouldn't be talking and you wouldn't be listening. And everyone that we know would have perished in 1983 had this official not had the presence of mind to go beyond the self-interest of the insanity of the ego and instead go for the shared interest of what is in everyone else's best interest. And he violated the protocol, which put him in trouble, at least temporarily, but saved the planet, because he wanted to make sure that the visual confirmation was there before launching a counterattack. And that's kind of the spoiler alert, so you kind of get the gist of a major part of the movie. But in essence, you kind of knew what the spoiler was going to be, because we're still here, right? But this was an actual historical incident that happened in 1983 that is, I think, an incredible testament to the difference between shared interest, which is what he acted on, essentially metaphorically taking up Holy Spirit's hand, and the Jesus of the Course, a.k.a., I like to use, inner kindness teacher, and whatever metaphor you like, and said no to the ego's denial of truth. And the truth being that we all are, deserve to be and to enjoy, our shared identity. But the ego's identity doesn't want to share it. The ego wants to be by itself, and that's the whole prodigal, the original authority problem. We think that we were going to be better off by dreaming a dream of separation, a dream of exile. So thank goodness the inspiration, despite the incredible stress that he must have been under, was uppermost in this man's mind, and he chose to, command his troops to hold off on the countertop until the visual confirmation was made, and it never happened. Of course, there wasn't any visual confirmation, and they only later found out that it was, computer malfunction, five times in one night, at the same time. So anyway, kind of cool, right? But what a great example, all the polarization and the seeming differences could come down to a single decision. But that's a great metaphor for the fact that the not know is really, as this question in chapter 21 suggests, the last unanswered question, the not know is really how we overcome, not by using polarization or opposition to deny the ego, because it ultimately doesn't exist. But what we do is deny the denial. We deny ego's denial and say that nothing happened. We're safe at home in the arms of God, metaphorically, where not one note in heaven's song was missed. And that is the peace that we all know, we all remember. We just, we think we wandered off and got stuck outside in the cold somewhere in some wilderness, you know, some desert. But another favorite Ken aphorism is, you know, when you realize you're in the desert, the thing to do is leave. And that's, the leaving is this, the denial of ego's denial. So the second paragraph continues, we must perpetuate this system in order to ward off an even worse fate, which is to acknowledge that there is no enemy outside and that we made ourselves powerless by choosing to believe in the thought system of separation and sin. Reason would tell us that if only we were to choose to consult it, which is to consult our right minds. And our right minds, of course, are the ones that, you know, that's the awareness that we brought with us into the dream, aka Holy Spirit again, all those, you know, whatever placeholder, name, idea, whatever works for you, that looks at the denial and says, nope. It basically says, that doesn't bring me peace, and I no longer am willing to settle for less than peace. And that's the willingness to really go through those the double shield of oblivion, the willingness to first look at the world and look at the insanity that is reflected back to us in the least irritation. Obviously, it could be a major thing, like that movie indicated, you know, the end of the world as we know it. A little plug for my brother's book there. I mean, that was one of his book titles. Different subject, but anyway. The reality, of course, is that, you know, we're free to choose against that outer shield by looking at it and saying, I don't want to identify with the miserable, pathetic state that is, you know, in all honesty, what this, you know, poor, cold, shivering little child, you know that, like one, lesson 182 suggests, you know, that we think what we, you know, we're abandoned, and you know, we feel sad. We think that somehow, you know, there's a neglect going on, but we made it up. It's a dream. But that's the outer shield of oblivion that really consists of everything in space and time, individuality, matter, energy, everything's from quarks to quasars. It's all part of that by default when we use it in the service of this crazy idea that suggests that something happened. And that crazy idea is, you know, manifest in a world that has just a whole lot of nothing going on. It's just, it has an incredible production value. It's like the best of all of Hollywood's and Bollywood's and any other special effects and movie house, you know, put together all the combined efforts of the most incredible, you know, resourceful, not just, you know, 2D movie, but 3D holographic production studios, if we can imagine that, put together. And you know, because obviously what we think of is that the universe is incredibly convincing. It's just amazingly realistic. But modern physics and ancient mysticism, and of course, miracles, being a pure non-dual metaphysical thought system, tells us that this is made up. And that's the outer shield of oblivion. So in order to complete the not-know process, we have to look at that outer shield. And not all at once. Obviously, we you know, that would freak us out, and we'd be plunged deeper into fear, as the Course suggests. So we have to, you know, over a period of time, whether it takes years, millennia, lifetimes, whatever, we get to choose our pace. We don't have to be pushed along, but the fact that we're interested in this probably suggests that we want to step it up a little and not just slum around in a thought system of denial and projection and not being happy. Why would we want to hang out in that ghetto of a thought system any longer than necessary? So in order to look at that, we have to just see that, you know, I could choose peace instead of this. I could choose a different, instead of ego's interpretation, I could choose the Holy Spirit's translation, which turns the prison into the classroom. Exact same experience in terms of the sensory data, but, you know, what we see and hear and taste, touch, etc. But we interpret it differently. Instead of seeing everything as an attack, a reason for us to want to retaliate and hit the nuclear launch button, you know, which is really the ego's only button. It has no option, and that's where the order of difficulties, you know, there's no orders of magnitude in pure oneness, right? So ego's retaliation always is a full-out, you know, full nuclear attack. It just is cleverly disguised as minor irritation or just being slightly annoyed or uncomfortable, whether it's physically, mentally, or whatever. But ultimately, it's all mental, right? So that kind of gets into the inner shield of oblivion, which is the idea that once we, you know, pull back, our inner Toto pulls back the curtain, and we see that all the smoke and thunder and all the fearful stuff that we think is outside us is really just a projection of our mind. And we see that, you know, we bring it back into our minds because the outer shield being everything in space-time, all matter, all energy, all form, all individuality, all personal stuff, all specialness, whether it's special love or special hate, that becomes then the threshold that we cross to where we realize, okay, this can't possibly be something that's insurmountable if I return to my mind. And that's, you know, ego marshals every possible defense to keep us from looking at the mind, because that's where we'll see the projector running. And, you know, up on that projection booth, if we turn around in the theater, instead of thinking that we're on the screen, we suddenly start identifying with the the screenwriter watching the screening of the film that he or she thought he forgot that he wrote or she wrote, you know, and suddenly you find yourself in the audience. You do have that option of turning around and looking up to see that little stream of light coming from behind, you know, over your shoulder from the projection booth, and then you realize, wait a minute, that's the cause of that is, you know, the cause of my experience is not on the screen, and my identity really isn't that. You know, dream action hero figure on the screen. It's the initially the person in the audience, and then we, you know, realize where it's coming from. We traipse up and realize, oh, that's a movie that I left on autoplay here, but I can change how I experience that. I may not be able to change the movie, but I can change how I think about it. And that's where we go past the outer shield of oblivion into the projection booth, realize it's in our mind, but that's, you know, ego, of course, has fortified the door to the projection booth with explosive bolts and guard dogs and lasers and you know, all the troops it can muster, because that's the last the last line of defense before it's undone. And so, thanks, Lynn, for the comment there. Let me see if I can get that on my comment stream here. So Lynn was saying, I am Gordon. This Russian guy is now old and lives in poverty in St. Petersburg. It wasn't so hard for him to understand that it was a false alarm. What is was hard is not to obey the order. They kicked him out of the military for that. Yeah, it doesn't go into great detail in the movie about that, but it does show him being reprimanded, which is of course ridiculous. I mean, but he did enjoy a hero's welcome in other parts of the world with a few movie stars. I won't you know, that'll be the least I can do to minimize the spoiler alert that I've already done. But anyway, that was a really interesting film. If anybody hasn't seen it, it's The Man Who Saved the World, and I recommend it. Not a kid's film, of course, but it's a really interesting film. So meanwhile, in the projection booth, metaphorically, that's our inner shield of oblivion, that ego is, pulls out all the stops. I mean, it already, marshaled everything it could find to keep us from looking off the screen and into the theater, and realizing that we're in a theater. You know, we no longer are suspending our disbelief. You know, we're starting to say not no by realizing, wait a minute. You know, we have those lucid moments and we realize, wait a minute, this is a dream. This is a theatrical presentation. Everything in space-time is something that I made up. But then the terror of thinking that it's real, there's still this, well, what if I looked in the mind and saw that it was horrible? You know, I mean, what if I found out that, that I really am guilty? Well, of course, once we get into the projection booth, we realize that it's a movie and the guilt is completely unfounded. But we don't know that until we look at it. And that's where and why the ego is so terrified that we look at the contents of our mind, because it's saying, boy, if you look there, you're really going to catch hell, because you threw God under the bus. You put the kibosh on perfect oneness and shattered that innocence and that peace. And that's its dirge that it sings incessantly, but disguised in many ways. And when we look at that, when we finally break through the door of the projection booth, see that it's a movie, and clearly that it's just an elaborate theatrical production that has no basis in truth. It's not even a documentary. It's just a fantasy of sin, guilt, fear, death, and other crazy ideas that are not consistent with the truth of what we are. Then we forgive it, and we forgive that decision making capacity that chose to make up this massive holographic movie, and we no longer can take it seriously. And I think we get glimpses of that when moment to moment we have those moments of lucidity and clarity and realize I could choose peace instead of this, and I am not upset for the reason I think. I actually could look at my life differently, and every single moment of it becomes that classroom instead of a prison. So we just talked about the inner and outer shields of oblivion. I'm going to go back into the answer in this FAQ here. The three questions stated in paragraph 5 have to do with our choice to exist in this world in which we seem to be the innocent victims of forces beyond our control. Our feeling powerless to do anything about the conditions in our lives is purposeful. That is such an important word, purposeful. And one of... at least one of Ken's audios or written work, I know I've heard it on one of his audios, is that Ken Wapnick shares this, I think, really insightful idea that Eastern mysticism gave us a tremendous blessing that we've inherited from the Orient of the idea that, this world is illusory. Well, in itself, that just becomes a nihilistic, horrific kind of thing. If you destroy the illusion or shatter that identity, but you don't have something wonderful to replace it with, then that could actually be depressing. I mean, that could bum you out. That just like one nuclear bomb could ruin your whole day. Well, that bombshell of realizing that if we follow ego's mantra anyway and follow its insane but perfectly consistent logic that we shattered God and nothing was left, then if that logic was true, you know, and if God was involved in the dream, you know, then we would be in in trouble. Then there would be no hope. But fortunately, that belief is purposive. That whole line of thinking, that whole misinterpretation that gave us, you know, the illusory world, and again, thanks to Eastern mysticism for that, is purposive because it basically provides a mechanism by which we can seemingly evade the wrath the punishment for a crime that we never committed. But we don't see that. We think that we actually pulled it off. We think we committed a crime. And so in order to you know, do a preemptive strike, we, you know, try to outdo God and say, we think we committed a crime, and then we think we need to minimize the damage by punishing ourselves because we think that, you know, we can do a better job and maybe get off a little easier than when God catches up to us. Of course, this is ego's little lowercase g God that is intent on punishing us because it's, of course, schizophrenic. You know, it loves us one day, hates us the next kind of thing, or moment to moment, whatever. But that craziness then becomes the justification for doing all kinds of nutty things. And, you know, like this line says, reason would tell us that if we only chose to consult it, our right minds, you know, we could choose against that thought system of separation and sin. And that choice then is basically to choose against the insanity and the craziness of thinking that we pulled off this impossible crime and that we deserve punishment. And also the idea that somehow we can project out and make the rest of the universe, including whoever happens to be crossing our path, the scapegoat. And so there's a phrase I like to use called goatscape. I think the outer shield of oblivion could also be called, you know, or AKA the world as we usually think of it could be called the goatscape, because that's anything on any given day within the ego's, you know, rifle scope or bazooka scope, whatever munitions it's got armed and loaded. Whatever shows up in the ego's crosshairs is fair game for hurling our guilt and projecting that onto somebody else. And that's the whole victimization, attack, defense, guilt cycle. You know, we feel the guilt maybe only instantaneously, unconsciously, before we then project it out again, only to discover that it comes back to us in either slight irritation or anything, you know, that whole spectrum between that and out terror and you know, horrific experience. But the least little annoyance is basically a reminder that we have an opportunity to choose again and to say no to the ego. So the last paragraph in this FAQ, number 287, is: the three questions stated in paragraph 5 have to do with our choice to exist in this world in which we seem to be the innocent victims of forces beyond our control. There it is. We think that, you know, we're at the mercy of everyone and everything else in the world. And what a helpless feeling. Yeah. Instead of being merciful, and I the word mercy has kind of crossed my path a lot lately, and I'm thinking, well, there's a great word to realize that, again, ego can misinterpret everything and make us at the mercy of, whereas if we respond to everything with loving kindness, whether it's a call for love or an expression of love, we are, you know, perpetually and consistently merciful. And it's the same word, mercy, but instead of being at the mercy of, we move the locus of control back to our minds and choose to be the instrument of mercy rather than the recipient of not enough of the same. And, yeah, it's all a matter of perspective, isn't it? So this FAQ answer continues. Our feeling powerless to do anything about the conditions in our lives is purposeful. Bingo, that's it. So that's what Ken says is the brilliant addition that A Course in Miracles adds to Eastern mystical traditions that suggest that, you know, the universe and everything in it is a dream or an illusion. A major, major, major holographic theatrical diversion, distraction, and deception. It keeps us from ever experiencing the true power of our minds to make another choice and deny our denial of the truth. There it is. So as long as we have the idea that we're an innocent victim or that we're somehow not at choice, somehow we have managed to become at the mercy of someone or something or some groups of individuals, whether it's a country or a race or a gender or a political party or a, you know, fill in the blanks, you know, any specific will do. And, you know, thus were specifics made. By default, we made specifics to make special love and special hate just watertight, airtight, you know. But like the Course says, it may be foolproof, the ego being the fool, but it's not God-proof, because that awareness in us knows ultimately that we can go beyond the space-time dream drama by choosing to forgive and choosing to just say no to ego's denial of truth. So I'll read that last sentence again. It keeps us from ever experiencing the true power of our minds to make another choice and deny the denial of the truth. And that other choice, I like to think of metaphorically the idea that what the real choice is that the Course represents, to return to our mind and to see that the guilt is unfounded there, that ego's, just to look at ego's insanity, look at the desolation that it has, is really a simple matter of just, you know, like metaphorically going up into the projection booth, going past the outer shield of oblivion and our enthrallment of identification with the character on the screen that we think, oh, this is, you know, I'm this Bruce character or whoever, you call yourself. I like Bruce of fiction as a reminder, because this character is a fiction. I deal with it on the level that it makes sense, but I like to remind myself that this is a fictional identity that I'm portraying here. But we get into that projection booth and smile deeply and peacefully and profoundly when we realize that you know, all the thunder and the smoke and the trembling, fearful images that you know, shook us to our core when we were especially identified with the actors on the screen of this melodrama, they're just a little bit of, you know, pixels on celluloid and going through a dim bulb in a darkened room. And it's only because, you know, we chose to hole up in a theater and hang out in this binge watching of space time that we think that somehow this is the real deal and all there is, and that's of course what, you know, just exactly what ego would want us to think, is that it doesn't want us to be aware, because the reason why we want to deny that is because we're heavily invested. Our whole portfolio of identity, for the most part, you know, we have these little glimpses, but for the most part, it's tied up in the personal, the persona, the this person that we see in the mirror and we slog to the bathroom every morning and say, oh, here I am again, because we identify with that fictitional character and think that's the real deal. And what a gently amusing joke. I mean, really. I mean, if we can just remember to not take that quite so seriously and just gently laugh, not in any kind of mean-spirited way, but just, you know, the idea that we could possibly limit all that is, the all of spirit that we really are, to this little finite, you know, just compressed into a little tiny bit of space out of the whole cosmos of a dream, you know, and the only way it could possibly happen is within a dream, because our true identity is totally inclusive and totally limitless and includes everyone and everything in the spatial realms and also in the temporal realms too, in all the seeming characters we've portrayed in however many lifetimes, and including all the alleged others, that, you know, who knows how that whole time space warp intermingling matrix works, but isn't it fascinating to think that, you know, that we're you know, not limited by time either. There's something that Lynn said in our conversation yesterday, which triggered an interesting aha moment, that, you know, that we're not limited by the temporal dimension as well. We think that, you know, if we take good care of the bodies we're hanging out in, that we might last a century, give or take. But at the same time, pun intended, there's this peaceful, gentle awareness that reminds us that there's something about eternity that we know that we never left. And above the battleground, there's that peaceful awareness that just gently says, "Oh yeah, nothing happened. Not one note in heaven's song was missed." So, I'll read that last sentence over again. I'm going to just start the whole paragraph again because it's really good. The three questions stated in paragraph 5 have to do with our choice to exist in this world in which we seem to be the innocent victims of forces beyond our control. Projection. Our feeling powerless to do anything about the conditions in our lives is purposeful. It keeps us from ever experiencing the true power of our minds to make another choice and deny our denial of truth. So the real choice, the real alternative is to, instead of all these horizontal choices of illusion A, illusion B, and all the different roads that fan out and branch out in every direction in the dream, if we get above the battleground and look down like the Cheshire cat with a gentle grin on the insane chessboard of ego's warfare games, we realize it's just a game. And the real alternative, the real choice, is to choose against illusion altogether, which in a sense is choosing against nothing. So it's really not a choice at all, ultimately. But we don't see that from where we think we're. So we have to use contrast from the context that we think we're in. So it appears that we're choosing against something, when in fact we're choosing against nothing. That sounds pretty easy when you think of it that way, doesn't it? Choosing against nothing. Oh, well, gee, I could handle that. That shouldn't be too difficult. but that's not usually the same perspective that we come from, you know, when we're in the thick of things. So I think it's important to be gentle with ourselves and patient and not condemn ourselves when we, you know, consistently experience the resistance and choose yet another illusion just because we're not quite ready for that perfect love. So, and then it continues. Hence the fourth question. The last unanswered question is, do I want to see what I denied because it is the truth? And that's also from chapter 21 in the text, section 7, paragraph 14. And then it continues. When we answer in the affirmative to the first three questions, we are saying that we have changed our minds and we really do not want to be the victims of the world anymore. But the last question has us confront our decision for guilt and the reason we uphold it. So there's that purposive aspect that the Course adds to the Eastern mystical tradition of seeing the world as an illusion and, you know, choosing not to be the victim. It says, unless we reverse that decision for guilt, we will continue to deny the presence of love and we will continually project that guilt. Bingo. Anyone else feel a bingo in that sense? I'll read it again. Unless we reverse that decision for guilt, we will continue to deny the presence of love, and we will continually project that guilt. So, of course, you know, the first thing that comes to mind is, and we need to forgive ourselves for doing that, because that just adds, you know, heaps more guilt onto the original guilt. It's sort of like seeing someone down in a pit and instead of throwing a ladder down, we jump in with a shovel and help them dig deeper, you know, or you know, or the kind of the old joke of, you know, is this a private fight or can anyone get involved, you know, that kind of thing. But that's that's ego's operandus. Modus operandi, isn't it? I mean, that's how egos work. They are constantly looking for a fight, for a grievance, for a reason to be either guilty or angry or feel put upon or victimized. And if we can look at that without condemnation, without beating ourselves up, and say, it's okay, I chose to be afraid of love, and that's, there's nothing wrong with that, because I still am invested in the separate self for a while, but I think we know intuitively, and you know, in our heart of hearts, the depth of what we are, that we're not going to do this forever. Otherwise, we wouldn't even be drawn to programs like this, you know, into forums like this. We wouldn't have bothered to tune into this, or to pick up A Course in Miracles, or to study whatever non-dual metaphysics we might be drawn to at any given moment. And the fact that, you know, we do want to undo our investment in that identity is, attested to the fact that if we really pay attention over time, as we mindfully look at the ego's insanity and say, no. I'm not going there again. I think I'm going to retire my merit badge in masochism, take it off, you know, and just say, yeah, maybe let's get a pair of scissors and take that off. I don't think I need that anymore. I don't need to wear that badge of martyrdom anymore, you know. Maybe not so much. And maybe it's only just, you know, we delay it a little. But we don't delay it quite as much. You know, the peace that comes from saying no to ego's denial. And then it says, the last question has us confront our decision for guilt and the reason we uphold it. Unless we reverse that decision for guilt, we will continue to deny the presence of love, and we will continually project that guilt. In addition to saying that our lack of peace or happiness is not the world's fault, it is our own fault, we must realize that the guilt within us is a deliberate choice to deny the truth of the atonement and then choose against it. So it's our own fault, but it's only until we look at it with that sense of responsibility and ownership that we get into the projection room and see, we loaded the film on the projector, but it's a movie. This isn't our reality. What a relief to see that it's just a horror flick, and we were in a state of stupor and insanity that we thought, you know, maybe we would get a kick out of this horror film, and then we realized not so much.
Bruce, I'm going to just jump in here real quick,
and
because this whole idea of the guilt that people tend to kind of brush over and think, I don't really have to look at this.
Right.
As I'm forgiven. I don't really have to look at this because it's a dream or an illusion. I don't really have to look at this because it is not real. But if you're believing that the world and the body and all the things that you think as you look around you are real, the only reason that you're seeing them is because there is guilt.
Bingo.
Guilt is the building blocks of this. If you're seeing the world when you're looking out of this attention that you are, if you're seeing the world of perception, it is because of guilt. And so to look at that guilt and to not be denying the guilt because we don't understand the, why would I feel guilty about that? Why would I feel guilty? It's not my fault that children are starving. It's not my fault that the global warming is taking over. It's not my fault that whatever it is, we claim that it's not our fault, and yet we know that really, if we're looking at a world and we're looking at a world of form that we would rather have than the truth, then it is our fault. Mm-hmm. I am making, I'm making the good, the bad, the ugly. I'm making all of these things because I believe I would rather have that than the truth. Mm-hmm. Am I willing to see what I deny because it's the truth?
Yes.
Or am I willing to just not look and have my cozy life or have my happy hubby or have my, you know, lovely children or, you know, whatever it is that I think I'm holding and I'm keeping safe, I'm really keeping it safe from me.
Uh-huh.
I'm the one who is making all the danger, making all the fear, making death. I'm making it up. Not right. Me, the Holy Son of God. Me, the ego, who believes in it and wants it to be true. And so until you recognize that, you're going to continue to believe that it's real, and you're going to continue to want it.
Right.
And so you can't say, I don't want it anymore. It hurts too much or it's too hard because you do want it or else you wouldn't have it. So I'm just breaking in to point that out. This is a big thing for me, is this looking at guilt.
Yes.
People are such in denial about it. Don't want to believe them. Don't want to believe it's true, but it is. So yeah, I'm going to mute my mic again and let you finish up. You have 4 minutes.
Okay, thanks, Lynn. And I really appreciate what you shared, which is so important too. And I really, it's at the heart of what this FAQ is about, and also, you know, what the course is about, is that if we really want to be honest with ourselves and see that anything that disrupts our peace is of our own doing, then that is the solution. Because if it's outside, if it's something else that somebody else chose and I'm only at the mercy of, then that, you know, we no longer have a choice in that insane thought system again. But once we realize that we can take ownership of it, then we are freed to look at it with the light of that inner kindness teacher's awareness that then shows us what we were hoping all along, was that there's nothing there. But we can't skip over steps. We can't, to your point, Lynn, and thank you for that very much, because if we try to skip over the steps of looking at the guilt, looking at the discomfort, being aware of how we feel moment to moment, then we're just going to continue to vacillate. So this concluding of a few sentences in this FAQ number 287 says, until we make that choice, we will vacillate all the time. To answer yes to the last question must mean not no. And there it is. There's the not no. It is to decide that I no longer want to be who I think I am. Separate, unique, autonomous, independent, free, and special. Well, of course, the freedom is a fake freedom. It's ego's freedom, which is really a fake liberty at best. I no longer want to see myself as distinct from the love of God, and there's the crux of it. We're so far down the rabbit hole of ego's insane dream, and we're so identified with these personal selves and the horrific dream that we made up that, you know, we're just trembling little children, you know, alone. Afraid and, you know, cold, alone, constant fear, whatever the phrase goes. You know, we think that we're in a world of hurt, but it's not true. And we can choose against the denial of truth. And anyway, so I hope you've enjoyed that. I'm reachable through acimblog.com. And Lynn and I have an ongoing series of conversations on this same forum on Saturday mornings at 6 a.m. Pacific or 9 a.m. Eastern. And anyway, thank you for chiming in a couple times, and I'll and feel free, of course, in the ones that follow. We're going to have 3 more of these, I believe, in the same time in the next few Sundays. And anyway, thanks for joining me, and have a great week, all.
Thank you so much, Bruce Rawls, and yeah, quite enjoyable. Great to listen to you, and just getting these very fundamental things in our minds straightened out to where we can actually see them and see what is actually going on, or the thoughts that we're using to continue the projection of the world. It's fundamental. If you don't have to believe it, you don't even have to know it. All you have to do is look. Mm-hmm. And when you look without judgment, these things begin to fall apart, and you actually begin to see yourself in your true reality, not as this limited being that we think we are. So once again, thank you, Bruce Rawls, and I look forward to speaking to you next Saturday and Sunday.
Yes.
So, all
very
right.
Very much. Thanks, all. Thanks, Lynn. Thanks, all.
All right. Bye-bye, Bruce.